Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Okay, I'm reading again the paragraph that we read last time about vyanjana, suggestion. Vyanjanabhida cha vrittir manyate mita gangayam gosha ityukte tannivasa bhutasya tatasya shilatva pavanatvadikam gamyam ityadi. Also acknowledged is the usage called suggestive. For example, when the phrase, there is a village on the Ganga, is spoken, implied are the coolness, sanctity, and so on of the shore on which that place of residence is found. Turuktam Shabda buddhi karmanam viramya vyapada bhava iti Nayenabhida lakshana tatparyakyasu tisvishu vitishu swam swamartam bodhayadvo pakshinasu yanyo arto bojate sa shabdasya artasya prakriti pratyades cha shaktir vyanjana nigamana dvanana pratyayana bhavabhiprayadi vyapadesha vishaya vyanjana nama. Such suggestion is described as follows. It is reasonable to say that when words, ideas, and activities cease, they have no more function. Thus, when the three functions of word meaning, called primary, figurative, and intentional, have each revealed their own sense and have ceased to act, yet another sense is revealed through another power of the meaning of words and of the bases, inflections, and so on that make up those words. This power called vyanjana is also variously referred to as suggestion, interpolated meaning, reverberation, implication, inner sense, and purpose. Okay, third mode of meaning. I'll read the commentary. Srila Jiva has discussed three kinds of word meaning, primary, figurative, and qualitative. And he has also talked about tatparya, the intentions of an author. Some theoreticians of poetics, however, construct categories differently. And so the quotation given here from the Siddhanta Darpana lists the three categories of word meaning as primary, figurative, and intentional. In any case, having dealt with those items, we now turn to vyanjana. In other words, Siddhanta Darpana lists mukhya, vritti, lakshana, and then tatparya. They don't count gauna separately, but gauna is then considered a subcategory of lakshana. Oh boy. It's not Siddhanta Darpana, it's Baladeva Vibhushan. Sahitya Darpana. Wow. Okay, good. Thank you. I'm making a note here because I have to fix it. What? I think we should hold off on questions. I think we should move. Okay. Well, yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. Okay, I have to make a comment here. Yeah, the book is given the wrong name. It's Sahitya Darpana. Siddhanta Darpana is a philosophical book by Baladeva Vibhushan. Oh, what does it matter? Okay, now we continue. Vyanjana is recognized by later authorities on Alankara Shastra poetic theory as the very life of poetry. According to Srila Kavi Karnapur. Yeah, we can just. It's in the file, yeah. Why don't you just allow it? I don't know, but just leave it for now. I gotta continue. Trojan Cryptor. It's in the file. Okay, why don't we turn? Why don't we quarantine it? No.
Quarantine.
What do you want to do? Then they're gonna terminate the program.
No, quarantine it.
Quarantine it.
Later we'll do it. No.
Quarantine,
it's okay.
I won't do this. Go ahead.
Hello?
No, terminate it. Go ahead, Jeremy. Okay, now.
Okay, what you do, switch off, mute the voice, volume, and let the voice continue. That's it. Mute the volume, and let it continue. Simply mute the volume, and we can continue.
It's already there. It was there yesterday too, last class.
Okay. Can we move, because in the future we won't get these sounds, muted. Okay.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Vyanjana, okay, according to Srila Kavi Karnapur, one of the great poets among the associates of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and author of the textbook Alankar Kostubha, rasa is the soul of poetry. Dwani, vyanjana, its life air. Words and their meanings, its body. And the ornaments of sound and meaning, shabda alankaras and artha alankaras, the decorations of the body. Rasa cannot be expressed by the literal or figurative meanings of words, only suggested by dwani. Therefore, a composition is not true poetry if it has no dwani. The phrase village on the Ganga is used as an example of both figurative and suggestive usage. Okay, now before I proceed, are there any questions on understanding what's been said about Vyanjana? But let's not speculate about further matters. Let's just, do you understand what Vyanjana is?
Basically, yes.
Please let me know if this question is not on the subject.
Okay,
but
yeah.
How does one recognize Vyanjana? Or is that going to be studied later on?
No, we won't get into that.
Okay.
And it's a very subtle thing. You have to be aware of it. You got to have a poetic sense. You got to hear with a poetic ear, because there are no visible signs. There's no inflections on the words that tell you here's a Vyanjana. You just have to develop spirit, a poetic radar to pick them up.
It's like this morning we're wondering why is the word Eva in that word, and then we said, oh, because actually it's just like the mitigation of misery. Well, when they don't really suffer, is that Vyanjana?
No.
Okay.
Because we were dealing with the literal meaning of the word Eva. Yeah, that was just. Yes, ma'am.
We've been seeing the definitions and explanations of Vyanjana. Can you please give an example from Bhagavatam, just a short example of how a Vyanjana is there like that?
Offhand, I can't. We have the, yes.
From some time ago, there was one verse. Maybe, this Daitya Kunjaram verse, maybe? Yeah, there was one verse in the Bhagavatam where it was describing, maybe we can look it up. It said Daitya Kunjaram, and it said something about the Lord being like a lion, and that kind of implies that,
You mean, Hiranyakashipu, somebody was the elephant among demons.
Yeah.
But elephants, can't beat a lion. Lion's better than an elephant.
Right.
That had to do with the Shringadev?
I think, do you remember what it was?
Okay, what is implied there? This is a vyanjana where it's an alankar. It's a, because it's rupaka, calling the man an elephant, is a metaphor. Metaphor is one of the alankaras. It's a, in this case, it's a shabda alankar. It's a artha alankar, because you could substitute another word and still get the same effect. You could use synonyms. It doesn't have to be exactly that word. So therefore, it's an artha alankar. It's a rupaka, or metaphor. What is suggested by that metaphor is actually vastu. It's actually an idea. The idea that Nrsingadev is going to beat him because Nrsingadev is a lion. And lions beat elephants. So that's an idea, that, you know, part of the plot, the story. The story is being implied by the alankar. So that's a vyanjana that's created by alankar, and the result of it is vastu, or an idea, an actual idea. Yes?
In the first verse of the Bhagavad Gita, Dharma Kshatre Kuru Kshatre Samaveto, Dhritarashtra speaks it.
Yes.
Prabhupada explains that the way, because he gave a lecture on that verse saying that it's a foolish question, because if somebody is hungry and he's given a plate of food, and it's foolish to ask what is he going to do next. So the same, they were all mad at one another and they got together in the place of pilgrimage, Kurukshetra, intended to fight. What did he do next? And Prabhupada says that this indicates his anxiety and
what's implied is
uncertainty about the outcome of the...
And confusion. Yeah. He's not thinking clearly.
Yeah, it's not in the words, yeah. But it's in between, and it's implied.
Yes, it's implied by the words, yeah.
Another example is Raja Vachana Mabra.
I mean, the words are very simple. What did they do? Oh. So straightforward. Yeah. Well, you know, there's nothing complicated about that, but there's a subtle implication.
Yeah. Another example of Duryodhana, when said there in the Bhagavad Gita, Raja Vachana Mabravit, he spoke words, which means that he's just like babbling and trying to get people on his side, being redundant in his speech, which also conveys his anxiety. Somebody explained like that.
The Vachanamabravit, I don't know if that's an alankar. It's a what?
It's a vyanjana, which implies his mental...
No,
anxiety.
I'm trying to see what... you know, anyway, I'm trying to analyze it in terms of what created the alankar, what created the vyanjana. What created the vyanjana was the redundancy. Redundancy is actually a fault, not a guna or a lankar. The intentional redundancy. When the redundancy is intentional for a purpose, it's not necessarily a fault. So it's an excusable use of redundancy that serves the purpose of implying his anxiety and confusion. Yes. But that anxiety and confusion is also part of the plot. It's also an idea. So it's what's the result of it is the idea that he's anxious. No. What did they do? There's nothing expressing any emotion in that. Yes, sir.
The third verse of the Mangalacharan, Nigama Kalpataror Galitam Palam Shukamukad Amrta Drava Samyutam. And Sridhar Swami explains in the commentary that because there is no matu pratyaya for the rasa and the phala, pivata bhagavata rasam.
It is rasa. Not it has rasa, but it is rasa.
Yeah, so it's like, isn't it like a vyanjana? Because it's not directly said that the fruit doesn't have any pith or seed,
yes.
But just by the usage of words, by saying that that's the phalam, which is the rasam, and it's indicated that... And it increases. It makes the reader, makes anybody who is reading more enthusiastic to relish the Bhagavatam. It gives a sort of eagerness.
Yes. The desirability or the ease. It's, you know, if you have to chew an apple, that's work. If you can drink juice, it's easier. So it's what's implying is the ease of application, ease of of swallowing it. Okay. We go on, we proceed from there. Ataitas chavritaya padavakyatvam apanesh evashabdeshu tatadarpam bodhyatum udayante. Tasya padatvam chavibhakti artalinganena jayate. Okay, now we're finished with analyzing the different vrittis. Now we move on to something else. Furthermore, these functions come into play to reveal their various meanings in verbal expressions that assume the form of words and sentences. Words come into being by embracing the meaning of their inflections. Does Panini say something like that? Words come into being by embracing the meaning of their inflections. Well, okay. Inflections do express meanings. We talk about, you know, the karma or the karta being ukta by the dhatu vibhakti. Okay. Yeah, but the thing is, there's a formal need for an inflection. Formal, that means it's just, you know, rules of grammar say you have to have an inflection. But beside that, in addition to that, the inflections actually say something. They express express part of the meaning. Beside the fact that you have to have them there. You can't have a naked word without an inflection. That's just a formal constraint. You have to have some inflection. But what inflection you have will change the meaning. So the words come into being by embracing the meaning of their inflections. You have the basic meaning of the word, but there's something added, more meaning is added, or the meaning is modified by the inflection. Like if you had a diminutive inflection. You know, like ika or ka. Ka means a small one, an unimportant one. Example of a word? It has in general it has the meaning, but not just case endings, also certain derivational endings modify the meaning. What I was pointing out is sometimes we add to the meaning, and sometimes we change the meaning by an inflection, especially derivational inflections. Okay. And then continuing the Sanskrit. Okay, so that's how words come about. Prakriti and pratyaya both contribute to the meaning. See, a word is a complex, the sound and the meaning. The relationship between them is the function of the word. The shakti is in the relationship between the sound and its meaning. So we're talking not only about the sounds that make up a word, but the meanings that are attached to them. Words aren't words if they don't have any meaning. They're just sounds. Okay, now that's how words are formed. Now what do you do with those words? Tani cha punar vakyatam apadya visheshartam bodhayanti. Those words proceeding to form sentences then express specific meanings. And there's this definition. Vakyam syad yogyata kangsha sati yuktak. What's the footnote for that? 664? Sahaja Dharpana also. Definition of a sentence. But I think he's quoting previous authorities when he gives that. It's not his own definition. It's an old definition. This is the definition of a sentence. You may think, why do we need to define what a sentence is? If we don't know what a sentence is, we're not talking. I have to use a sentence to define a sentence. So, isn't it obvious what a sentence is? Why do we have to define it? Well, we want to be scientific. We're linguists. We want to, even though we use the language all the time, we want to step back and analyze it. So let's define what a sentence is. This definition says, a sentence is a collection of words that has coherency, expectancy, and proximity. It's not just enough to be a collection of words. It has to have these three qualities to be a real sentence. Coherence, expectancy, and proximity. Then the next quote is also Sahaja Dharpana, 669. Okay, so Sahaja Dharpana continues to explain what these three conditions mean. They're called, yogyata, akanksha, and asati. Those are three feminine nouns. You studied this already? Good. Tatra yogyata padarthanam paraspara sambandhe bada bhava anyata vakina sinjati ityapi vakyam syat. In this context, coherence is the absence of obstruction to the mutual relationship of words and their meanings. Well, words have natural relationships with their own meanings. But if you put incompatible words together, then things get obstructed. They don't fit. It's unsuitable to put certain words together because the meanings don't mesh together. Since otherwise, he moistens with fire would also be a sentence. So that's not supposed to be a sentence because it's not appropriate. You know, you don't do that. You don't moisten with fire. Yes? Only if you recreate the universe and change the laws of nature in your poetic universe and let the fire do moistening. In some sense, if you know, it can become a sentence if you change the meaning of the words, and a poet can do that. But the ordinary meaning of the words, it doesn't fit. It's nonsense to say, it's just nonsense. He moistens with fire. It doesn't mean anything. Because you could say it does mean something, but it means something nonsense. Meaning is there, but it's not a suitable sentence because the meanings don't properly fit. The verb moisten, it's not appropriate to put the object fire with it. Yes. Not object, I'm sorry, instrument, fire, with fire. No, let's wait. Let's make some progress here. Okay, well, let's finish the definitions of all three at least, and then you can ask questions about the definitions. Prajapati apmano vapam upakidat. There's a little bit of doubt whether we got the right translation of this one. Some Vedic statement, the Lord of creatures took out the membrane surrounding his own intestines. Okay. In such a statement, there is coherence due to the inconceivable potency of such persons. You might say, well, this is also a nonsense thing. You know, nobody pulls out his own intestines. But Lord Brahma could. Yeah. By his inconceivable potency. So that's allowable. You know, the words in a special situation it becomes appropriate to put those words together. There's actually some situation it's describing. You know, what we're doing is, words should refer to something. You know, if we make a word that doesn't have any meaning, it's not a word. It has to refer to something. Maybe not a thing, but some something out there. Some relationship, some quality, some motion. Something has to be referred to by a word, otherwise it's not a word. Well, now we're saying a sentence not only has to have words that have meaning, but the whole sentence has to refer to a real situation. We're not the kind of theoreticians that allow nonsense sentences about square triangles and all and stuff like that. They're not sentences. And even if the words aren't compatible, you talk about things that just never happen, it's not a sentence. It's a strict definition of sentence. You might want to be more liberal and let nonsense sentences be sentences also. But this is a strict definition of a sentence. It has to do with the coherence of the meaning. We're using the term coherence here. That means that A and B fit together. I have a kind of glue that works, that sticks things to paper. It doesn't work on glass. I have to use a different kind of glue. So there's no coherence in using the wrong kind of glue to try to attach something to a piece of glass. You have to use a special different variety of glue. So there's no coherence. You put these two words together, they just don't stick. They're still just two separate words and they don't stick together to make any meaningful, any sentence that actually describes anything real. Therefore, no coherence. They don't stick together. The Sanskrit word is yogyata, literally suitability. But yujasa means connection, so there's no potential for connection. Yogyata. Okay, now the other two qualities of a sentence. akanksha, that's expectation. Akanksha pratiti payavasana viraha shrotri gigyasa rupaha. Anyata gor ashva purusho hasti itya api vakyam syat. Expectancy is the inconclusiveness that arises concerning recognition when a hearer wants to know more. Well, like, give me. Now, if I'm talking baby talk, I could say give me, but it's not a proper sentence. You know, it's okay for babies, but adults should tell what you want. Give me what? Give me. Give me the cup. Give me the book. You need it, you know, it demands an object. You're expecting an object. It's a transitive verb. You expect at least a direct object, if not also an indirect object. The verb give expects an object. It's transitive. It's sakarmika. So we have an inconclusiveness. I just say the word give. I'm expecting another word to finish the sentence. So there should be such expectancy between the sentences, between the words and the sentence. Were it not for expectancy, cow, horse, man, elephant would be a sentence. Cow, horse, man, elephant. There's nothing unsuitable about having, you know, out in your backyard all four of them, a cow, a horse, a man, and an elephant. You can arrange for that. But it's not a sentence because there's no expectancy. There's no relation, there's no verb with karakas, there's no, you know, it's not a sentence. Expectancy means to have syntax, to have some verb there, and to have a subject or an object, at least one or the other, and probably some other words too. And you expect to have them there. Cow, horse, man, elephant is not a sentence. Now the third quality, proximity, or asati. Asatir buddhya vichedaha. Anyata idanim ucharitasya devadatta padasya dinantara upacharitena gachati itipadena sankatik syat. This is also should be there to have a sentence. Proximity is the non-interruption of a thought. Without proximity, the word devadatta spoken now and the word goes pronounced tomorrow could join together to make a sentence. You say the two words, they would make a sentence, but you say the first word today and the next word tomorrow. There's too much distance. It's not a sentence anymore. Okay? So, you know, the words have to be pronounced at the same time to make a sentence. Okay. Atra akanksha yogyata yor at marta dharmatve pi padocheya dharmatvam upacharat iti. And that's the quote from Sahitya Darpana. And although expectancy and coherence among the characteristics of a sentence are actually qualities of ideas in the mind, by figurative extension they are considered qualities of words in combination. The expectancy and the coherence. The asati is literally of the words. The words have to be pronounced close enough in the same time. That's a quality of the words themselves. But the expectancy and coherence are actually, strictly speaking, qualities of the meanings of the words, of the ideas. But we figuratively consider those qualities of the words. Don't worry about that. That's okay. Words are anyway, you know, they all have meanings attached to them. Or you can consider the word the combination of the sound and the meaning. Okay, any questions about that? It's not too complicated. Words come together to make sentences, and a sentence should have certain qualities to be a real sentence.
I was thinking an example of currents, coherence and poetry. They drink his beauty through the eyes.
Yeah. Well, it seems incorrect. By figurative usage, you can drink through your eyes.
It's figurative. Okay.
It's figurative, but it's still coherent. It's allowed on the not on the literal level. If you're not If your teacher says, no figurative statements, please, just be literal, then you can't say that. But if you're allowed the freedom of being figurative, then there's coherence there. It's not just poetry. Even in ordinary language, we have to be figurative sometimes. We don't have enough words for everything. We have to be sometimes paraphrastic or figurative.
Another question is about expectancy. The way
it's really syntax, what it really is.
The way it's said here, it seems like it's a fault. Maybe I'm misunderstanding, but
why?
Inconclusiveness that arises concerning.
No, because there's an inconclusiveness. Because one word by itself doesn't convey a complete idea. It expects another word to finish the idea. There's nothing wrong with that expectancy. That's how sentences get created. I have one word, but it doesn't say the whole idea. I say, give me. Give. And I'm saying, and I'm expecting, well, give what? I can't give you anything until you tell me what it is. You know, okay, I'm willing to give, but what is it you want me to give? So the verb expects an object. That's not an abnormal or faulty condition. That's how sentences work. It's normal. And without that expectancy, without that inconclusiveness, without that expectation, well, what comes next? You wouldn't bother to put words together in a sentence. You'd just grunt or just say single words. But we have to use grammar in order to express complete ideas because of expectancy. Otherwise, like cows, we just moo five different ways, you know, five different kinds of moos, grunts. And we get along with that. But we want to be sophisticated human beings and talk about complicated things. Then we have to use grammar. And that's one word expecting another word to complete the idea. That's not faulty. That's human language, which is unfortunately more complicated than cow language. But most human beings manage to learn it. Yes.
But we expect a sentence to be complete and give a full meaning of, I mean, if the sentence is, doesn't
yes.
convey the full meaning, then it's supposed to be incomplete sentence.
The sentence, yes. So when the sentence is complete, you get a full meaning. The expectancy has been satisfied. Otherwise, you have an incomplete sentence. But now we're going to talk about, even on a higher level, that sentences may demand further information in other sentences, and you have bigger compositions that are whole paragraphs or whole books. Like, we are going to define what is a sentence. That's a sentence. It has a complete idea, but it leaves you with an expectation. Okay, what's the definition? You're telling me we have a definition. Well, I want to know what it is. So the one sentence is expecting another sentence. The idea is complete grammatically, but it's telling you something's going to happen and you want to know the details. So there's a different kind of expectancy on the higher level of linking sentences together by expectancy.
Also, this definition of sentence holds true for prose and poetry, or is only for prose?
Yeah, all kinds of sentences. You don't even have to talk about poetry. Any sentence. Any sentence has to have all three qualities. Any sentence.
But as we were discussing previously, poetry can violate all these rules and it can create its own set of rules.
I don't know how far you can go.
Like, for example, just now you said a sentence.
You can violate certain rules and you have to be expert about
like
it.
The sun.
If you violate all the rules, then what you say in as so-called poetry would be totally incomprehensible. If you violate all the rules of grammar and you change all the meanings of the words, nobody will understand what you're saying. You can call it poetry, you know, put your name on the book, my poems, but nobody will understand what you're talking about at all if you break all the rules. There's a limit to how many rules you can stretch.
But these three components, I'm saying that
They're there in prose, then they have to be there in poetry too. Poetry is made out of sentences. Ordinary poetry. There's modern poetry where they just, you know, sprinkle words, you know, letters on a page and they don't even make up words. But that's not real poetry. poetry should have meaning. It should be made out of sentences that are made out of words.
For example, this proximity and coherence, we see that some verses, the word which we require in a particular verse may be found after five, six verses or previous, something like that.
That's allowable. It just should be on, you know, at least on the same day. You know, well, it should be reasonably close together.
But
if you're reading poetry as a coherent whole, and you're not just reading, like, if you decide I'm only going to read one verse a day, but the sentences actually stretch out, extend over more than one verse, you're not going to be able to read it properly. You know, in the Bhagavad Gita, the Bhagavatam, we have many sentences that occupy more than one verse. So if you decide I'm only going to read one verse a day, or one verse a month, then you're not going to be able to coherently follow. You're going to have to read enough of it to get the whole idea. If it's five verses together that make up a complete idea, and all the pieces don't fit together till you get to the end of the five verses, then you have to read all five. Otherwise, anyway, you're not properly reading it if you only read a little piece and then another piece the next day. Not, that's your fault. The sentence was properly composed, but you're not reading it right.
Just wanted to know the connection between the previous topic, the vyanjana, which we were discussing, and now he's giving the definition.
I know, but we're done. We said we've discussed the vrittis, and now using those vrittis, we put words together in sentences. We're changing the topic. We're not talking about poetry now. Right, but when we went off on a side discussion about how words have meanings in different ways. Directly, you know, literally, figuratively, and suggestively. We dealt with that and we finished with it.
Like you spoke about phonemes, the letters that compose words.
Yeah.
And then he speaks about the words, and now he's speaking about sentences. Seems like a gradation.
That makes sense, no?
Yeah, seems like a
gradation. That's how you build it up. Smaller pieces make the bigger pieces. Yes.
If Yanjan is explained to be a separate function of words besides their literal meaning and...
A separate function. It's a separate way of words giving their meanings.
Yeah, so if it is explained like that as a separate function... Then how can we meaningfully argue that vyanjana depends on the words having their literal meanings? For instance, if somebody like Lewis Carroll comes up with a bunch of completely meaningful words, how can we rule out that those words will still have some vyanjana, besides the fact that the author is a moron?
You could argue that it's not real poetry, it's not real language, that... When you use nonsense words that don't really have a meaning, then it's pseudo-language. It's not really even language. Language is made out of words that have meanings. And then you've got pseudo-poetry made out of your pseudo-language. Mm. And by some mystic power, Lewis Carroll has been able to create a poetic effect, but it's actually pseudo-poetry.
It was Brillig and the Sleazy Taoist did Girl and Gimbal and the Wave, something like that. It was complete. No word had any meaning, but...
Some of them do, actually.
Some, maybe.
There is some meaning there, and therefore there's some effect, because there is... But it's like distorted language. When 80% of the words don't have any meaning, it's not normal language.
But if somebody calls it pure and pristine, vyanjana, because there is no contamination by...
Not by the standard traditional definition of vyanjana and all these things. They're based on the actual meanings of words. Uh-huh. Everything starts with the literal meaning. Uh-huh. Then you can do things on top of that. But if a word doesn't have a meaning, it's not a word.
I guess Bharat Ram Prabhu showed me a few verses by... Was it Rupa Goswami who wrote verses like made of two letters or three letters?
But it's always analyzed that every one of those... funny words has a meaning. Uh-huh. The proper explaining of the verse has to assign a meaning to every word. We don't have nonsense verses in Sanskrit poetry. You won't find Jabberwocky in Sanskrit. Yeah, that's not allowed. I mean, you could try to translate it into Sanskrit, but it's ordinary Sanskrit poetry doesn't allow such a thing. Hobile. Yeah, but it has a meaning. It's a mythical beast, but it, you know, it has a meaning. You know, he eats babies and hides under your bed. Yes?
Is it that the Vyanjanas are explained by the commentaries by Acharyas and Prabhupada explains the purport? Is it so? All the Vyanjanas?
Sometimes. In practice, when you're reading poetry, you're lucky if you can find a commentary at all. And you're lucky if the commentary actually explains the Vyanjanas. Sometimes, some commentators explain. A lot of times you're on your own.
In Bhagavatam?
It's very difficult. It's very difficult. It takes years of practice to be able to pick out the Vyanjanas.
In Bhagavatam we have several commentaries, so is it...
Yeah, but they don't talk too much about these things in our Bhagavatam commentaries. Because Vyanjanas all over the... In poetry, Vyanjanas all over the place. Not one verse should be devoid of Vyanjana. But it's mostly... It goes on without thinking about it. You know, Vyanjana is there without analyzing it. So it's only a special kind of commentary that gets involved in analyzing the Vyanjanas. Because Vyanjana is something that you have to have a sympathetic heart to experience. It's not something you analyze to death. It's not an analytic thing, actually. It's a thing of the heart. So therefore, it's sort of artificial to make an analytic, you know, study of it. It's done. Sometimes it's done, but you don't see it too much. Vyanjana is appreciated in the heart, not in the brain, actually. An example of which? I'm sorry, what commentary?
Vyanjana commentary.
Well, I can't remember exactly. You know, there's some, you know, I have an upstairs, we have several mundane poetry books, Kalidas and others. And a few of the commentaries in some of those books talk about Vyanjanas. I think we have a book, Chaitanya Chandrodaya Mahakavyam. And the commentator there talks about some of the figures of speech, some of the Vyanjanas and Lakshanas, but not all of them. He'll point out in some verses some prominent ones. If you want to say, I started to write a commentary on Madhurya Kadambini. So I took the first verse and I analyzed it pretty thoroughly for Vyanjanas. You can look at it. Yes.
Goswami's verse which he wrote as an explanation of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's ecstatic verse about the Treva River and what was that? That he was, I'm the same, you're the same, and I'm the same.
Yes.
Is it an explanation of Vyanjana or is it something else? Rupa Goswami wrote a verse which explained the deep meaning of the verse.
It has to do with it. It's not an analytic. It's sort of a...
Poetic retranslation.
By a poetic translation, revealing, revealing the Vyanjana, but not by, you know, putting labels on everything and analyzing it.
Translation, right?
Yes. Okay. By the translation, he's pointing out the hidden meanings. Yes. So, you know, the study of Vyanjana is sort of a do-it-yourself thing. It's not like you can take a course in it and learn 100 rules for this and that. There are definitions of 63 or more different Vyanjana, different alankars, and analysis of hundreds of different kinds of Vyanjana. But for application, you have to practice and pretty much learn it on your own. You can learn the theory, but the theory is very confusing until you get practice in applying it. And it's like, I mean, how do you learn how to swim? You can go to a classroom and learn theoretically how to swim, but you have to jump in the water and swim. And you have to do it by yourself. No one can swim for you. It's like that. You have to, in your heart, experience the reverberation. And then you get a sense of what it is. Madan Mohan? No. Okay, anything else?
Can we cover a little bit more?
No. Out of time. Okay, one more paragraph. Okay, next paragraph. Tat chavakyam mahavakyanugatam. Mahavakyam chavakya samudaya. Asyartas tu upakramopa samharadi bir eva daryate. Tatahi upakramopa samharav. Abhyaso purvita palam. Artavad upapaticha lingam tatparya nirnaye. What's the reference for that? Brihat Samhita? This is standard. Mimamsakas use this. These six lingas or six signs to look for. Translation. A sentence, moreover, belongs to a Mahavakya. A Mahavakya is a group of sentences whose meaning is ascertained according to its beginning, conclusion, and so on. Of course, I could just have, like, you know, in my exercise book or on a test, 20 sentences that have nothing to do with one another. You know, you just have to translate each sentence. You can put sentences together in a certain funny context where they're not connected. Just, you know, 20 interesting sentences. But also, you often put sentences together to make a bigger composition. That's called Mahavakya. Up to the level of a whole book. Okay, now, the Mahavakya has, although the words have specific meanings and the sentences have specific ideas, but then there's a general sense of what the topic of the whole composition is, or the whole section. What's it called? Artha. But it's the artha of the Mahavakya, of the Prakaranam, of the whole section. Like, what is the Bhavatam about? Well, there's thousands of sentences in the Bhavatam, and they're talking about thousands of different things. But there's a general sense of what the Bhavatam is about. It's about Krishna and his devotional service and his devotees. How do you get that idea? By looking at the six signs of what is the general sense of the whole Mahavakya. What's the topic, the main topic? So these are the six signs. A Mahavakya is a group of sentences whose meaning is ascertained according to its beginning, conclusion, and so on. As it is said, this is the definition, the signs used to determine overall meaning are beginning and conclusion, repetition, novelty, result, praise, and logical reason. That counts as six, because you put beginning and end to go together. Because something is likely to be the main topic if it's mentioned both at the beginning and the end together. Okay, now we're going to stop. This is just a preview of what we're going to discuss tomorrow. We'll define each of these six and give examples. I'm sorry?
Novelty.
These will be defined. Tomorrow we'll read that. Okay. We haven't defined any of them yet. Even the words that make sense, they have technical meanings. So we'll learn the technical definition of all six. Yes.
Yeah, I'm just wondering about Mahavakya, because we also hear, like in CC, like the Mayavadi say that Tvamasi's Mahavakya. Is that a technical meaning?
Yeah, because there the Mahavakya is a very small sentence.
Right.
It's a couple of words only.
Right.
That means a really important sentence.
Okay.
So you know, crucial, essential sentence. But that's not. This is a different idea of Mahavakya. This is a collection of many sentences.
Is that like a Vedanta terminology, that how the Mayavadis
use it? It's a Mayavadi terminology. I don't know if the Vaishnavas use that term.
Right.
It's the Advaitavadis in Shankara school. Each of the different branches of the Shankara school, each of the mutts, have their own Mahavakya. They have each have a different slogan.
Okay. Slogan.
Yeah. Okay. So we stop here. Thank you, all glories of Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.